You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyon SRAM. Today we are in Modena.
Cozze citene, cozze, cozze piscine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze citene, cozze, cozze piscine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Sono le ultime fasi con la maglia di Iwan, rinvia Neviviani che tenta di affiancare Iwan. Attenzione De Mar, De Mar!
Tobias, can you talk me through that finish?
Oh, it was quite fast. It's a drag racing the last 45 kilometers. In the end, I thought it was a crash in the rear with Pascal Ackermann. I think me, Singeldam, Jacopo, in a good place, stay safe, and in the end we could win.
Ramon, can you talk me through that?
Oh, it was really chaotic. All of us waited for the last 5K. Yeah, all the sprinter teams knew what was coming, and I think there was a big rush. Luckily we were in front, and it was really stressed out. I think we all did a good job, not perfect, but at the end I know one, and that was count.
It was pretty a mess after the last turn. I decided not to follow all the time Ramon, because we knew sometimes we hit the front too early, and the idea was to come behind with the speed. So actually there was some kind of misunderstood, and Tobias Ludvigsson and Singeldam, they inverted their position. But I just stay a little bit more far back than them. So I didn't remember exactly what I did, but I think I went on a Lotto Soudal lead out. I just take a breath and then I started my lead out for him. I think he was fast enough. When he started the sprint, he was already in the lead, and he simply did the sprint really, really clear, and I think he won without any big problem. It was clean sprint, and that makes it even better. It was he won with the legs. That's really important. We knew he was in shape. We didn't prepare perfectly the Giro, because all the group did Paris-Roubaix at the end, and the other sprinters, they stop Gent-Wevelgem, so we had 2 weeks more of racing. But maybe we missed something in the first days, but now we're back on track, and for sure we had the morale, and we keep the same morale, and we hope to have another one before the end of the Giro.
You said last night you had an aperitivo in the hotel. Yeah. There's one being prepared behind me. Actually, you better watch out, or else people will say Groupama have got a drink problem.
No, it was not for us, it was for the invité of the team. But yeah, for sure we're going to have another spritz tonight to enjoy the victory.
Well, Daniel, we heard there from the Groupama FDJ lead-out train in the order that they dropped off stage winner Arno Demar on his way to victory in Modena this afternoon. That was Tobias Ludvigsson, Ramon Singeldam and Jacopo Guarnieri.
Big old boys, aren't they? Napalm. We spoke to them at the finish, and the first thing that occurred to me, Lionel, just having sort of assembled all those voices, is how well supported Arno Demar has been at this Giro d'Italia, and he kind of needed to pay them back, really, or pay his sponsor and his team back for supporting him so well here. But it's, as we have discussed, it's not been an easy task for the sprinters at this Giro.
In cycling terms, they are big men, aren't they? Ludvigsson and Singeldam and Scottson and Legac and Konovalovas are all tall guys, a bit like a sort of a front row in rugby, pushing forward and allowing Demar to burst through and win the sprint. It was a pretty uneventful day on the Giro d'Italia, wasn't it? Until the last 3 kilometres. It went from Ravenna this morning to Modena. Not a pimple on the profile today, was it? It was as flat as you like. And presumably the Giro organisers were hoping that maybe wind would blow and turn it into a sort of an intense 140 kilometres. But it was still enough, wasn't it?
Balsamic vinegar country. It was kind of slightly acidic for a lot of the sprinters, wasn't it, today?
It was, yeah. Well, the tale of the tapper then. Two riders got away right at the start, two Giro debutants, Luca Covilli of Bardiani and Sho Hatsuyama of Nippo Vinifantini, who was in a big break in the first week, wasn't he, the Japanese rider? And they weren't really allowed a lot of time because of the the length of the stage, only really sort of three, four minutes, and most of the controlling was done by Groupama FDJ, with Miles Scottson on the front for kilometre after kilometre. De Koenig Quickstep were up there as well for Elia Viviani. The two leaders were caught with 29 kilometres to go, and then that was kind of it until the last 3 kilometres, when the Spaniard Francisco Ventoso of the CCC team tried to do a Fabian Cancellara by accelerating away.
Kind of by mistake, because he looked around. He was hoping that his sprinter, Jakub Marečko, who's not had a great Giro thus far, he was hoping that he was in a slipstream. We thought, Lionel, that today might be a great finish for Marečko. Why? Because the finish line was overlooked by Burger King. Now, for those who listened to the podcast in the first week might get the reference already. Chiro spotted Marečko in a McDonald's, and this led to a minor scandal because one of Chiro's colleagues in La Gazzetta mentioned this fact and sort of suggested that it was unbecoming of a Giro d'Italia sprinter. Really, he was just in there to use the bathroom, I think. However, and there was a Burger King at the finish line. Literally, it was the best view in the house today, wasn't it? People were enjoying their Whoppers, and I've never been to Burger King for 15 years. I don't know what they sell there, but Whoppers. I remember Whoppers. But apparently there was also a McDonald's on the other side of the road.
Wow, Burger Wars in Modena.
But it didn't do Marečko any good, did it? And Ventoso looked around, saw that his sprint train had gone AWOL and carried on.
And he was caught really inside the final kilometre. And then there was a really nasty crash with around 800 metres to go when the bunch was travelling at its fastest. And it seems from early reports that Rüdiger Selig, a lead-out man for Pascal Ackermann, touched the brakes, and Ackermann in the Ciclamino jersey, Bora Hansgrohe, a sprinter who's already got 2 stage wins under his belt, he went down, the most visible rider to go down, because obviously he's in one of the leaders' jerseys, but a lot of riders went down, and only probably a big dozen really made it through. Groupama FDJ were in great position, but so too Caleb Ewan and Elia Viviani looked like they were going to make a good run for the line. Viviani at one point I thought was coming on very strong, but he didn't have enough to beat Demar. Slightly distracted in the tail of the tapper there, Daniel, because the arrival of a plate of salami and a couple of gin and tonics.
Yes, I don't think I've ever had a gin and tonic in Italy before, but yeah, without asking, we were presented with 2 gin and tonics. We're also Lionel, well, we're staying in the Provincia di Mantova tonight, not Modena, because we had a bit of a cocker with our accommodation. Not our fault. So we had to go... No, definitely not our fault. So we had to go slightly north. So we're in the Provincia di Mantova, and we're staying in a place which makes its own Parmesan. And also, the gentleman who runs our bed and breakfast has told us they make their own salami.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons Run.
Today is one stage for sprinter, and so we have one is Belletti, the bomber. 4, the riders that help Belletti in the sprint. 2, the rider of overall classement, and so they are in the peloton. And 1 is Marco Frapporti, who is a freelance. Freelance. If he wants, he go and break away and to for the 2 classement. Kilometer in breakaway and traguardi volante.
Well, Daniel, I witnessed Gianni Savio giving you his formation for today live. It was a thrilling moment, I have to say.
You witnessed the unadulterated glee with which he delivers this information to me every day. And do you know what, Lionel? The remarkable thing about today's formation was that today's bulletin was that he hadn't even told the team yet. And he said, right, wait there. Well, he told his riders, wait, a minute. I'm going to give the exclusive to the Cycling Podcast. Then I'm going to get on the bus. And then I'm going to reveal the formation to you guys.
Well, we were outside the Androni team bus for a very important engagement to present the first Pedaler de Charme Rafa t-shirt to the winner, Marco Frapporti, for his very charming gesture helping Larry Warbass into a rain jacket the other day. Rafa, of course, supply the Pedaler de Charme t-shirts, and you can buy one too. I wouldn't let Daniel wear one the other day, but I'm getting a bit of flack for that on Twitter for not letting you wear one, Daniel. But if you want to buy one, or a jersey, or the Pedalers de Charme equivalents, you can go to rafa.cc. Now, Gianni Savio, his formation didn't really work today.
Well, the bomber Belletti is doing okay. I mean, he's had a couple of top tens, another top 10 today. But Napalm, you know, just watching about the sprint, I think, you know, there were so many lead out trains spread across the road today. It was a big boulevard finish, a perfect finish in a way for the sprint teams, but there were also GC teams up there until very late, as we're accustomed to seeing now. But I think, you know, I remarked to you after the finish that this Giro, we kind of thought that it might really establish a new sort of pecking order in terms of sprinting. And to a certain extent, and Pascal Ackermann has established himself at the top of the hierarchy, just based on the sort of the sprints that have been the ones that have been most kind of, or the cleanest, the sort of most sort of undisturbed by mitigating factors. He's looked like the fastest guy. However, it hasn't been emphatic, has it? And I think, just looking at today's, when you know, it's a wide road and there are a lot of lead out trains, I think some of the sprinters are confused about what to do in those key moments, those where they have to make key decisions. They're not sure whether to abandon their lead out man, lead out train, and go with someone else. And that's really what happened with Caleb Ewan today. Roger Kluger was doing a great lead out, but there was a moment where Demar had gone on the other side of the road, on the left hand side of the road, and I think that Ewan kind of caught sight of Demar and thought, no, that is the wheel I need to be on. And then he kind of changed his mind again and went back towards Kluger. In the meantime, Kluger was sort of finishing his lead out, but the last sort of 50 metres of his lead out had been in vain because there was no one really on his wheel. And a similar thing happened with Viviani. Viviani seemed to lose Sabatini. Viviani sort of hinted yesterday, he spoke to Ciro, he hinted that he's really missing Michael Morcu here. And, you know, he also looks as though he's maybe lacking a bit of speed.
What about Arnaud Démare, though? Because that was his first victory of the season. And he won a stage of the Tour de France last year, almost a sort of forgotten man of the sprints, really. He came very late, won stage 18 in the Tour last year. He's not a kind of conventional fast man, is he? He's got a bit more to him than that. And I always kind of assume he's going to be good on maybe the tougher finishes rather than the real drag strip finishes. And it was interesting to hear the Groupama FDJ riders talking about just how fast it was on the run-in. And to get the better of Viviani in those circumstances, impressive. But what about the Italian champion? I mean, he is one day away from ending his Giro empty-handed. We're anticipating that a lot of the sprinters will go home tomorrow night. Viviani and Caleb Ewan almost certain to go home tomorrow night, because really there's only one more opportunity after this, and Viviani is more, well, he's a long way behind Ackermann in the Ciclamino jersey, although he's made up some ground today. But it's not going to plan for Viviani at all, is it?
No, it's not. But on the other hand, he generally finds himself in a position to sprint, which is already a good sign, because a lot of sprinters, you know, sort of get lost in the wheels with a kilometre to go and they can sit up. So Viviani always gives himself a chance. I don't know. I sort of think that it's a matter of time for him. We think he's going to go to the Tour de France, and I think he'll be very competitive there. I mean, I don't think the level of sprinting at the Tour de France is going to be that much higher than it is here. I think the lead-out trains will be of a better standard. You know, we remarked on the fact again about Demar and Groupama. They've really brought their A sprint team here, and that has put a bit of pressure on him. He's a guy who's not, it seems, has not always responded all that well to pressure, particularly in the classics. There've been a couple of Paris-Roubaix when he's really been talked up and talked himself up in the lead up to the race and has not really delivered. And as far as sprinting is concerned, I mean, it's so hard for these guys, because if they don't win, then it's regarded as a defeat and a failure. And he's not as prolific as, you know, a lot of the best sprinters in other teams. And I don't think he's ever going to be one of the most prolific sprinters in the world. But I think he could definitely sort of carve out, and he's carving out a position for himself as a kind of Alexander Kristoff type rider, you know, someone who in certain circumstances is very dangerous. And those circumstances tend to be, you know, when it's very hard, on big stages, you know, when he's up against some of the best riders in the world. And that really tells you what a quality rider he is.
Yeah, I mean, he's completely out of the points competition, actually, because he lost, obviously, the 50 points for the relegation in the first week, and was penalised another 50 points. But it's close at the top between Ackermann and Demar, and you wonder whether one or both of those may continue through, thinking that they might win the points jersey. Demar will do the Tour de France, though, right? And Ackermann certainly won't, because Bora Hansgrohe will have Peter Sagan, and they will have Emmanuel Buchmann, and their team will be built around those two riders for the sprints and for the GC at the Tour de France. But so Ackermann, as long as he's okay after his crash today, and the early reports are that, you know, nothing broken and just cuts and bruises, we imagine he'll try and battle on, I would have thought.
Yeah, one rider who I don't think will battle on is Matteo Moschetti, who I saw after the finish, who was really badly beaten up, and I saw him getting into an ambulance with a Trek Segafredo team doctor, and not sure exactly what injuries he has, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's a collarbone issue, plus assorted cuts and bruises.
Well, in the next part, we will be going back to yesterday when we were in Cesenatico and our visit to the Marco Pantani Museum. And in part three, we will hear from Team Sunweb's race coach Matt Winston, and also from the young Welsh rider making his Grand Tour debut here, Scott Davis of the Dimension Data team.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet interrupting our Giro coverage to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by the British Heart Foundation, and specifically the London to Brighton charity bike ride, which is in its 44th year, older even than me, but not by much. It's a charity ride that raises money for the British Heart Foundation's research into heart and circulatory diseases, which are still responsible for 1 in 4 deaths in the UK. So it's a ride for a great cause, and the cycling podcast will be there in force. We've put a team together to ride. Richard Moore will be there. Rose Manley will be there. Simon, the photographer, will be there. I'll be there. Daniel, I've not been riding my bike much lately, but I have been training.
You were looking very lithe and spry yesterday, Napalm, when I passed you on my run. I saw you on yours.
You did pass. I can't fail to point out that you passed me on your run, but you did pass me on your run. I'm trying to keep, you know, trying to keep the weight off while we go for these sumptuous dinners.
Tough.
It is tough, yeah. It is tough. But the great thing about the London to Brighton ride is that it is a real social day out on the bike. It's 54 miles long, so it's challenging enough, especially if you're, you know, maybe a novice, or, you know, for older or younger riders. 17 miles of the course are on completely closed roads, and it goes over Ditchling Beacon. Does that mean anything to you, Daniel?
I've heard of it. Yeah.
It was in the Tour de France course. You've heard of that in 1994 when it came to Britain. That doesn't really count as a Tour de France when it's in Britain for you, does it, Daniel?
No, not really.
No. If you'd like to join the huge peloton snaking its way to the coast on June the 16th, you can get £5 off the entry fee by going to bhf.org.uk/L2B2019 and entering the code Brighton5. We've put together a team, as I say, and if you'd like to sponsor us, the Cycling Podcast team, sponsor us, please do. Go to justgiving.com/the-cycling-podcast. We've raised around 1,500 quid so far, and we'd like to raise more before the off in mid-June.
Adesso aspettiamo di vedere il pirata Bogaert in prima posizione. Eccolo là, eccolo là sulla sinistra. Si è tolto la bandana.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we appear to be in the Marco Pantani Museum.
in Cesenatico.
And it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? Whether you're a fan of Pantani or not, as a collection of cycling memorabilia, from bandanas to bikes to trophies to newspaper cuttings, it's quite remarkable.
It is. And right in front of us here, we've got the pink jersey, the pink skin suit, Mercatone Uno Giro d'Italia skin suit from 1998. We've got the yellow jersey from the Tour de France, also 1998. We've got his King of the Mountains jersey from the Giro, a Bianchi bike that he rode with Mercatone Uno.
We've got a documentary of the 1998 Tour de France playing behind us.
Everything, shoes, helmets, stuff from when he rebranded himself as the Pirate, Il Pirata.
I just saw some Pirate, Il Pirata sweatbands that I might have to invest in at the till.
Are you going to run in those along with your Mappe visor?
Well, I might buy a Pantani bandana. They must surely sell a Pantani bandana. His ergometer?
Trophies as well, and race numbers. I'm really conflicted about what I feel about Pantani. I think the fact that he died it means that I have a great deal more sympathy for the position he holds, not just in Italian cycling but in cycling in general, as a kind of, you know, symbolic of flamboyance but also excess. He was pushed by a nation, wasn't he, to exceed his own ambitions in a lot of ways, and I think that the way that his life came to an end was it was a kind of modern day tragedy, really. And looking around and seeing just how beautifully kind of cared for the memorabilia from his career is, it's quite moving now that I'm sort of settled in here and having a look. And also, like the bikes and stuff, there's a Carrera bike from the mid 90s period and the Bianchi time trial bike from the late 90s, just shows you how almost dated this stuff looks now. And yes, it's 20 years ago that he was ejected from the Giro d'Italia after recording a high hematocrit level, one of the biggest modern scandals, up there with the Festina scandal, really.
This legacy really was created in such a short period of time. 1994 was when he broke onto the scene and winning two stages of the Giro, and you know, then he had 2 years in 1995 and 1996 were pretty much wiped out after his terrible crash in Milan-Turin, and really after that, the only two more glorious seasons, 98 and, well, part of 97, all of 1998 when he did the Giro Tour double, and then 1999 up until the fateful day at Madonna di Campiglia when he was kicked out of the Giro for high hematocrit, and then his descent began.
It did. I mean, and looking at the newspaper front pages from L'Equipe, Gazzetta dello Sport and some other newspapers there, I mean, it's looking at the language used, particularly when you consider that the Festina affair had tainted the start of the 98 Tour, you know, Pantani attacking there. Basically, he's a giant, you know, it's a giant. I mean, Vai Pantagiallo, that's go Pantani in yellow, I guess. The sort of the sense at the time that Pantani was some kind of saviour for cycling after the Festina affair had wiped out Richard Virenque and several others. It's kind of ironic, really, but at the time, you have to remember that the sport was absolutely crying out for somebody to shine brightly, and he shone so brightly, you know, almost like Icarus, really. And when you, with the hindsight of history, you can see that those tremendous highs of 98 and the way he absolutely dominated two-thirds of the Giro in 1999 before being kicked out.
Lionel, I think we're about to get kicked out. It's lunchtime, and Pantani's family, of course, used to own a piadineria, selling the, you know, one of the big local...
It sounds like food.
Well, one of the big specialities of this region of Romagna is a piadina, which is kind of a savoury filled pancake. But we're going to go and see if it's still going, and maybe, Lionel, order one up ourselves.
Before we go, there's a fantastic mural here of Pantani being knocked over by some kind of buffalo. I'll take a picture of that, I think.
Attenzione, Pantani sulla sinistra. Lo si intravede, ma è già pronto per lo scatto.
La piadina. Allora, la piadina è la piadina normale.
Sì.
Dopo invece il crocione è come il calzone, viene tipo rotolato.
Ah, ho capito. Comunque,
e poi vanno nella piadina vanno gli ingredienti dopo. Ah. Invece nel crocione prima, poi si mette sulla piastra.
Ah, ho capito.
È sempre l'impasto della piadina, non cambia niente.
Sì,
solo
so
che
it's the same dough, but
crocione con il more like a sandwich and the other one
and the other one crocione the ingredients get cooked in the
yeah.
Io prendo un crocione alle erbette miste,
piadine, salsiccia, cipolla,
la 23. Ok,
so Napalm, what do you go for?
Well, I think I've gone for a piadine with sausages and onions. What have you gone for?
I've gone for a crocione, so you know, see what comes.
See what the difference is, I guess.
You know, they've been making piadinas in this family for decades, so they should be pretty good at it now.
Since 1985, in fact.
We've got some lovely pictures behind us, more Pantani memorabilia, more pictures of him winning the Giro in 1998, more pictures of Pavel Tonkov, my favourite.
There's one behind you of him in the shark's mouth, and I'm not talking about Vincenzo Nibali.
So, Napalm, you went piadina. I went crescione. Difference?
Yours looks like thinner bread, more like a pita pocket. Mine is sort of flatbread sausage sandwich.
Yeah, the filling of mine looks somewhat healthier than yours.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, yours is green. But I've got some onions.
Go on then, give us your verdict.
Feels like a sausage sandwich from home.
Lo scatto di Pantani, avevo detto due erano le possibilità per Pantani, o puntare alla vittoria di tappa o puntare alla classifica. Ecco il testa a testa più atteso, Ulrich nella scia di Pantani, Ulrich.
So Napalm, we've been to the Spazio Pantani, the museum, and we've just had a piadina from the Piadineria Pantani.
Yeah, well, the most remarkable thing was how much like Marco Pantani the man at the next table looked. Shaved head, sticky out ears. I mean, I was convinced he was, I don't know, an uncle or a cousin or an older brother or something. But no,
nothing
related.
To do with him. Nothing to do with him. There is a lot in Cesenatico that is in Pantani's honour. Clearly, his sort of spectre looms large still here, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. The thing about the museum shop was that all of the memorabilia was fantastic. I mean, it was a real sort of treasure trove of Pantani's career and achievements, jerseys, trophies, bikes. But the sense that Pantani's still a commodity is, you know, lingers in there with the... that some of the souvenirs were a little bit tacky. I'm not sure anyone needs a Marco Pantani signature cigarette lighter, for example, do they?
Well, some of the proceeds do go to charity. There's a Marco Pantani foundation. But no, I take your point. You know, Pantani, I suppose, always was someone whose image was manipulated, used in a period in sort of Italian cycling, Italian sport, when they were on the lookout for an icon, and they got one in Pantani. And it was, you know, a period when Italians really dominated professional cycling, and those days are gone, aren't they? But Pantani's legend certainly hasn't gone. There's a kind of a mawkish nostalgia, not just for Pantani but for that period. You know, we're in a part of Italy now on the Adriatic coast where cycling has really been eclipsed and almost obliterated by motorsport. This is a huge area for motorsport, and a lot of the same things that were projected onto Pantani have since been projected onto particularly MotoGP pilots, people like Valentino Rossi, you know, who's seen as a kind of anti-establishment figure, a bit of an iconoclast, in the same way that Pantani was.
The one thing I keep thinking about Pantani is how much of that marketability was created when he decided to shave off his hair. Because when he won the white jersey in the Giro, best young rider, I mean, he looked about 48 then, with the kind of the width. And I can say this as somebody who lost his hair prematurely, that moment you make to shave it all off is quite a significant thing. But he kind of became a much more confident character on and off the bike, I think, but and yet retain that kind of vulnerability, and you know, all of the things about his physical appearance that must have kind of influenced and affected his character. And that's something that's always interested me.
And Lionel, there's this kind of discomfort around remembering Pantani and honouring Pantani, and even here in a Piadineria run by his family, there is this kind of latent sense of awkwardness. You're not really sure whether you can broach certain things. The Piadineria is run by his sister Manola. We asked whether she would talk to us. We said we were on the Giro with journalists, and you could tell there was a bit of diffidence, understandable. But you know, this place is a shrine to Pantani. The museum is a shrine to Pantani, and yet there are certain subjects which are still quite difficult to negotiate about Pantani. You know, how much of his legend was built on a lie, and how much was natural talent. You know, people still say that, you know, if no one had been doped in that era, Pantani would have been the best. That can't be proved. We can't know that. There are people who sort of sniff at his legacy and sniff at his palmarès, but he was a child of his era, in the same way that Merckx was, Anquetil was, and before them Coppi and others.
And let's have some empathy about it. He paid the ultimate price, didn't he? I said, you know, the sort of Icarus syndrome. He flew too close to the sun, and he didn't just plummet to earth. He really hit it with a thump, didn't he? Where the downfall was swift and hurtful to him. He couldn't understand why he could go from hero to zero so rapidly. And, you know, his kind of descent and difficulties, you know, personal difficulties, I mean, basically depression and drug addiction. I mean, it's very hard not to look at the whole package and end up feeling that Pantani is a sympathetic character. You know, he paid a tremendously high price, and probably his last days were extremely miserable. And, you know, it doesn't matter really what anyone does it within a sporting context. You know, that was a high price to pay.
Ulrich recupera Pantani sui pedali. Pantani si volta. Ulrich in seconda posizione, naturalmente una differenza di rapporto. Ulrich incomincia a voltarsi. Questo guardare intorno, questo guardarsi in giro denota una un'insicurezza.
The Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Congratulations to the first winner of our Science in Sport nutrition bundle. That's Christina, who on Instagram has the handle City Girl Rides. Well done, Christina. If you'd like to be in with a chance of winning a nutrition bundle and some Rafa kit next week, all you have to do is follow the Cycling Podcast on Instagram and share the latest episode in your Instagram story. We'll be announcing another winner on the second rest day. Remember, you can get 25% off all Science in Sports products by going to scienceinsport.com, and when you check out with your basket bulging with energy bars and gels and so on, enter the code SISCP25. Daniel, are you getting munched by mosquitoes?
No. Usually in this region of Italy, this time of year is terrible for mosquitoes. So we're in Mantova, we're at the bottom of the Pianura Padana, the huge, well, the Po Basin, you call it in English, don't you? The huge expanse of flat land that goes from, well, the foot of the Alps up in Piedmont, all the way over to, well, beyond kind of Venice in the east, and it's going south to sort of Bologna and even a little bit south of that, towards the Adriatic coast. And yeah, no, there's hardly any wind. It's one of the least windy places on earth, generally, the north of Italy.
I think you said that last year.
I think,
yeah,
I did. Well, yeah. Were you saying I'm repetitive?
No. I think one year gaps between anecdotes is a lot less than the rest of the
world. And yeah, it's very damp here. So conditions, unfortunately, conducive to mosquitoes.
Well, we were in Modena this afternoon, of course, the home of balsamic vinegar, in a kind of sweet spot, a kind of corridor of greatness in Italian cuisine, but also the hometown of Luciano Pavarotti, who is synonymous with the 1990 World Cup because his song, not really a song, is it? Nessun Dorma, not really a song. I suppose it is a song. He sung it. That was a theme tune for the BBC's coverage of the 1990 World Cup. If you're old enough to remember that, that will probably get the hairs on the back of your neck standing up. But also, a stone's throw away from Maranello, the home of Ferrari. There's an Enzo Ferrari museum in Modena, but the whole area is Ferrari country, isn't it? And of course, the big sports news, this will be big sports news for La Gazzetta dello Sport tomorrow, won't it? The death of Niki Lauda, former Formula One world champion, of course, and in fact, the only man, this is a kind of cycling Venn diagram here, the only man to have won the world title for both Ferrari and McLaren. So the Giro finished in Modena, more or less home of Ferrari this afternoon. And McLaren, of course, are the technical partners of the Bahrain Merida team. And we're kind of yet to see how this marriage between the motor racing giants and the cycling team has really manifested itself. Maybe we will. I was asking you yesterday whether, having seen a story in La Gazzetta dello Sport about Rod Ellingworth leaving Team Ineos to go to Bahrain Merida, whether this is the sort of thing that's going to get Italian cycling fans frothing and excited?
Well, I think the team is probably going to have its Italian heart ripped out, or sort of Bahraini Italian heart ripped out. I think it will take on a slightly different complexion, that team. But speaking of sports science, Lionel, we had a couple of interesting questions thrown up yesterday when we spoke to Simon Yates, didn't we? For those who listened to the press conference, our podcast yesterday, they'll know what we're talking about. But this idea that the start of the Giro has been so flat and, I mean, a lot of spectators have said uneventful, that it's actually led to some riders and possibly Simon Yates losing form. Now, I spoke to Larry Warbass at the end of today's stage, and he said that his average power today was 149 watts, which was less than his little sort of spin on the rest day. He suggested that I could have stayed in the peloton today. I think I suggested that he was probably wrong about that.
I couldn't. But, I mean, that's not intimidating watts, is it?
No, and tomorrow, if tomorrow is similar, then it will effectively have been the fourth or the final one of four consecutive almost rest days, because for the domestiques in the field, we've had the time trial on Sunday, which a lot of them will have been able to ride relatively easily, then the rest day itself, then today and tomorrow again.
Well, this morning I went to the Team Sunweb bus and spoke to Matt Winston, who used to be with the One Pro Cycling team, the British domestic team, which was run by the former cricketer, Matt Prior. And he also worked with British Cycling, of course, for a number of years. And he's the race coach for Team Sunweb. And I asked him about this, whether this phenomenon of detraining is, whether it's there's any kind of validity to it. But I also put in my crackpot theory, expecting it to be blown out of the water.
After the time trial, Simon Yates was talking about the possible phenomenon of almost detraining in the opening week of a Giro like this, not having had enough intense efforts and paying the price in the time trial a little bit. And I just wondered whether that's a kind of valid theory from a performance point of view, thinking specifically about the week we've started with.
When you come into a Grand Tour, you kind of look at the stages that are coming and you want to come in the best possible shape. But there is also a theory for this, with this race, with the sprint stages, the first week being really loaded with sprint stages, that you would probably want to not come in at your best and try and look to backload that, especially for the climbers in week, middle of week two into week three. So I guess maybe if you've come in red hot, then there is that potential that you're coming kind of off the curve a little bit as the road starts to go uphill. And it's something that maybe everyone's different though in that scenario, but it's something that you would need to manage and look at the stages as you're building, I guess, as you're coming in towards it.
Now, I know Tom Dumoulin's not in the race any longer, but how had you as a team planned his form? Had you gone with that theory of coming in, you know, maybe not screaming hot, knowing that all the difficulties in the last week?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not Tom's personal trainer, but yeah, I know the performance team were kind of looking at that and as part of the planning. But, you know, as we saw on the first stage, that was a key time trial, especially for Roglic, who took a lot of time in that first time trial over other guys. So it was you're always going to need a balance, and it was almost like on a knife edge. You need to come in with enough to do the first TT in good shape, but then also have enough to be week three. And I think that's what's going to be really interesting for, because Roglic's in such great shape, and he has been all season, and I'm sure he has it all under control. But week three, if he comes through week three in really good shape, then I think he's had an amazing first half of the year, you know. So
Now, these races are all about getting those peaks of performance and timing them with when the event demands you to be at your best. So, I mean, thinking about what Simon Yates has said about the possibility of the week being too easy, I mean, he said he's not been in the wind, he's not really had to make an effort except on day one and day nine. I mean, I know this sounds absolutely ludicrous, but could there be a development where riders are doing a hard hour on the turbo after a stage? I mean, we've seen the kind of the warm up and the warm down become normal now. I mean, is this the next kind of step in performance, or is that a step too far? Is that a ridiculous idea?
No, I think, like I said before, I think everyone's different and everyone trains in different ways, and that's what makes cycling as a sport so interesting, because what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another. I think your theory has potentially got legs, and it's something that I'm sure people will look to explore. But this is also quite a unique first 10 days, I think, of a Grand Tour, where you don't normally get 9 days where there's nothing. Like in terms of the road stages, not the TTs, but like in, yeah. So it, maybe if it happened again and you got your road book and the first, because the next 2 days also he's in the same position now where it's pretty much going to be a sprint day. You would, I guess, look at that, and yeah, maybe an hour in the morning on the turbo or with the later starts or at the end is something that could be explored, just to kind of keep that intensity in there.
Well, Daniel, I was quite surprised that Matt Winston didn't just laugh at my suggestion that riders might end up doing an hour on Zwift or Trainer Road or just on the turbo, just to get some intensity into their legs and the heart rate racing on days when there's not much doing. And when we were talking about this earlier, you had another idea, another suggestion that,
well, they could do the hard workout in the race, couldn't they? I mean, with no goal of gaining time or particularly putting rivals under pressure, but you know, if a team wanted to come to the front and ride hard for 20 minutes, they could, purely in the name of putting in a big effort, which, you know, the kind of effort they haven't done for a week or two.
But we're so conventional in the way we watch the races. I mean, if Simon Yates today had gone to the front and ridden on the front for 15 or 20 minutes hard, we'd be absolutely aghast. We'd be saying, what on earth is he doing? This is energy wasted. And then, you know, if nothing transpired in the final week in his favour, we would look back at that and say that was an absolutely ridiculous thing to do. So I would say that any of this is in the short term is going to have to be done in sort of secret, in the, you know, within the team, you know, in the team hotel or whatever, so that we can't see and judge what they're doing. I think it's less likely that they would do it in the race than it is to do it back at the hotel or in the morning. I mean, could you imagine, though, you've got a 140k race, not knowing what it's going to pan out like, doing a hard hour on the turbo and then being in the race thinking, I wish I'd not done that. And yet we have this phenomenon that some riders are struggling to adapt to the relatively sedate pace of the race, and it's catching them out.
Yeah, you know, anecdotally, even going back decades, I think you've heard riders talk about kind of needing a big effort to open up their legs. I mean, there's an expression in Italian, una tirata di collo, like a literally, you kind of need a noose around your neck and for it to be sort of yanked to kind of bring you into, coax you into form. But you know, the physiologists now, and every team has a team of physiologists or sports scientists, they have such great information and data, and I think they will be looking at the body of data that they're getting from this Giro, and they would have been fascinated by it because it's been so atypical, so unusual, and I think it's kind of busted through and sort of confounded a lot of their models and a lot of their paradigms based on previous Grand Tours. And consequently, we might see some of the Grand Tour or some of the riders here who are going for general classification get some nasty surprises about their condition.
But doesn't this this should all add up to make Simon Yates feel hopeful that Primoz Roglic might suffer some kind of sudden collapse at some point in the race? We've talked a lot about, well, Matt Winston talked there about coming in screaming hot, which we think Roglic probably did because he won the Tour of Romandy, which finished a week before the Giro started. So, you know, that we are looking at sort of bell curves of different riders, and it's the one that gets the peak of their bell curve in the right part of this race that's going to win the pink jersey in Verona, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, Lionel. And, you know, it's something that we sort of taken as, we take as read that form can only last sort of, or top form can only last 4 to 6 weeks. Something we should probably go into in even more detail in the next few days. You know, it's a basic, it might seem a banal question, but why can form not last forever? It's received knowledge in cycling that it can't last forever. But why? Primoz Roglic, I don't know, we were busy, we were rushing around going to the finish today, but I read a tweet just before I went out to the finish line today which said that Primoz Roglic goes for a run every morning. I think this is probably a lie.
Fake news,
or it was supposed to be a joke. However, quite intriguing. One thing I do know about Primoz Roglic, he enjoys a glass of wine in the evening.
Every evening?
The only rider at Jumbo-Visma who regularly, I think pretty much every night, has a lovely glass of red.
Well, he's in the right place for it, isn't he?
Well, he is. We're in Lambrusco region, Lionel. We're quite big advocates of Lambrusco because it's, of course, had a terrible reputation in the UK. It's been absolutely bastardised and its image has been ruined.
Yeah.
Do you know what's been ruined this year? The Lambrusco harvest and the Lambrusco vintage, the crop is already ruined for 2019. I mean, I've been reading some reports in the local papers over the last couple of months, and the weather has been so disastrous that the Lambrusco producers are talking about having lost a third of their crop already.
Goodness. Well, the one that really...
I'm losing another third tonight when you get on it.
Steady on now. Now, hang on. Our colleague Andy Hood posted, or Velo News, his magazine and website, posted a piece today. What do the journalists do on a typical day at the Giro? And Dan Lloyd, if you're listening, Dan, he posted that picture that you took of me the other day with the lavish antipasti, and I'm enjoying a post-race beer, to suggest that that's all we do. That's not all we do. But the Lambrusco here was a revelation to me a couple of years ago, the fizzy red, and I bought some at home, and I've got to say, It didn't travel so well. You know, it didn't go down quite as well in a chilly, not Watford, as it did here.
Well, Napalm, do you know what? Tonight we might eat some donkey stew. Now, it will be more appetizing than it sounds. Stracotto d'asino, which is a speciality of Mantova. We're not quite in Mantova, we're about 20 kilometres away. It's the donkey meat is marinated for between 12 and 24 hours in Lambrusco before being cooked.
Quite like donkeys.
Yes, maybe report back tomorrow.
It's enough to turn me vegetarian, that. Before we go, this morning we saw a group of Welsh fans outside the Dimension Data bus, and they were here to offer some support and encouragement to Scott Davis, the 23-year-old Welshman riding his first Grand Tour for Dimension Data, former Wiggins team rider, of course. And, I spoke to one of the fans and then to Scott Davis himself about how his first week as a Grand Tour rider had been going.
My name's Richie Harris, also known as Agus, and we're all from Cwmcarn Paragon in Wales.
Why are you at the Giro?
We came over for the week to obviously support a couple of the local British guys, and obviously we've ridden the Nova Coli, which was a fantastic event, and obviously young Scott, obviously I was with him when he first started racing, and obviously keep an eye on him, give him a shout, you know, look after him. So
you're from his club?
Not from his club, no, obviously we're all from Wales, so obviously, yeah, we come up with a special, you know, effort to come and see him this morning, like, but yeah, he's probably 50 mile away from where I live, but obviously when he was a junior and youth, obviously you'd seen him coming through and raced against him a few times, so we just come and give him a shout this morning.
When you first saw him, did you think this lad's a bit special?
He was a good lad, and he's obviously very, very committed. Obviously, even when he was doing his exams for his GCSE, he was out at 4 a.m. riding 6 hours before his exams, so yeah, you knew he had the aptitude, even if, you know, you didn't know he had the ability to do it. But yeah, he's a fantastic kid, like, yeah.
And what have you made of his Giro so far?
I was just saying, I said I was a bit worried for him the first week because obviously he's got a bit of a dodgy stomach, like, you know, and he's suffering, but he had a great TT, and I think he'll just get stronger now and enjoy it, like, you know.
Well, have a fantastic week here.
Thanks very much. Thanks for your time.
How's your first week of your first Grand Tour gone?
Yeah, tougher than expected. You know, I think it was a really tough week for anyone anyway, and everyone anyway. I had some stomach issues, which made a tough week pretty hard. Luckily, I'm over that now, so yeah, it was worth suffering through it, and so I'll see how today goes.
What were you thinking when, you know, you're not feeling 100% physically and it's your first Grand Tour? Were you kind of, you know, cursing, or is that just part of the occupational hazards of bike racing?
Yeah, to begin with, obviously, no one likes to come into their first Grand Tour not 100%, but after a while I just accepted it, and to be fair to the team, they've been mega supportive. So yeah, it's been right in the end. So like I said, I'm just glad to be over it now, and hopefully that's it in terms of bad health for the rest of the race.
And a good day in the time trial on Sunday.
Yeah, that was really unexpected actually. So yeah, I think I did get really lucky with the weather there. I think that probably played a big part. But yeah, the goal was just to get through it, so I didn't actually go full gas, which looking back I kind of regret a bit now. So easy with hindsight. Yeah, I'm still really happy with it to crack my first top 20 in a World Tour race.
Some good British weather, good Welsh weather, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah. We've definitely been using our rain bags a lot this week. Yeah, I think today's looking sunny, so that's a bonus.
Big group of fans here from your part of the world, a few familiar faces, that must give you a bit of a lift.
Oh, it's really nice. Yeah, I didn't know they'd be here today, but yeah, I know a lot of those boys from my time on the Welsh time trialing scene. So yeah, nice. Always nice to see a familiar face.
And what's kind of the job for the second half of the race, and particularly the mountains? I mean, are you familiar with the mountains that you're going to be riding, and what's your role in the team going to be?
Yeah, I'm not too familiar, to be honest, with this being my first Giro. You know, the under 23 races don't really go up there, so I think my main role is to help Ben O'Connor as much as I can, so yeah, we're all fully behind him. And yeah, hopefully we can have a good week, or 2 weeks rather, when we start hitting the big mountains.
Well, that's all we've got time for tonight, Daniel. A packed episode, more eventful than the stage, I'd say. But thank you for taking me to the Marco Pantani Museum and introducing me to Piadine.
Didn't get any sweatbands, did you, at the Pantani Museum? I thought we could get you a bandana.
Oh, too cliched, that, a bandana.
It was funny, actually, Lionel, when I was putting that package together, I was listening to some old commentary clips of Pantani. What a fantastic ritual that was, that Pantani had, of throwing off the bandana. What a fantastic theatrical moment that was, that really fed into this whole sort of mythology that's built around him. You know, there were even occasions in the Tour de France and the Giro, in fact, where he would take off his ear stud as part of this sort of striptease that he would do before he was about to attack, and his attacks were completely telegraphed, but obviously they were irresistible.
I mean, it was before the days of social media, but I mean, he may as well have sent out a tweet before an attack. Sometimes it was so obvious, he'd kind of drift across to one side of the road and look at everybody and get out of the saddle and then go for it. But it was interesting period, that, wasn't it? And it was good to go and see just what he means in his hometown, because I think we kind of get caught up in thinking that Pantani is kind of, you know, everybody's property, but you know, he's somebody who is still loved and respected in Cesenatico despite everything that happened to him. But yeah, that, I enjoyed that as a little detour off the beaten track. Hopefully we've got a few more of those planned before I go home after the weekend. But that's all for this episode. We'll be back tomorrow night, of course. If you've not been keeping up with Kilometre Zero, please do so. Our series goes out on Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings. My mind has just gone completely blank. What was the most recent one, Daniel?
Giuseppe Virelli.
The
Girina, La Girina.
The woman who is basically at Mauro Venier's side. The suspicion from listening is that she's kind of doing all the hard work while Mauro Venier has the sort of the lunches and speaks to the media.
I'm not sure about that. I think they have a similar modus operandi. They don't take any nonsense, either Giuse or Mauro.
Well, hopefully the Giro haven't got this far. The organisers haven't got this far in this episode. Anyway, we'll be back tomorrow night with another... Well, we're going to have to be creative again, aren't we? With another, probably another sprint finish and another long... Well, a flat stage, but a longer one this time. But until tomorrow, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Lionel.
Se lo mangiano le femmine.